Okay, last case for argument, the Bruin versus Appleton Papers, Ms. Brostrom.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ellen Brostrom, and I appear here today on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Deborah Bruin. There are three layers of error raised by this appeal: evidentiary, procedural, and substantive. Did Bruin raise disputes of material facts showing that Appleton Papers claimed that it terminated her because she was a dishonest and abusive supervisor is false. It is a fabrication. Specifically, the affidavit of Sandy Van Ert, the June 23rd email, and the contradictory deposition and affidavit testimony created a dispute about whether Appleton Papers believed that Bruin was a dishonest and abusive supervisor. The contradictions between the affidavit and the deposition testimony are extreme. Lisa Vertier, one of the three allegedly complaining subordinates, stated in her affidavit, quote, in February of 1999, my sister was taken to the emergency room. The next morning, I told the woman I was taking the afternoon off to be with her for her surgery. She got very upset, telling me I can't do this. She said, you know what it is, it's cancer. I got very upset. Contrast that with her deposition testimony. Quote, I had taken a day of vacation from my sister's surgery, and I stayed in the hospital that night. The following day, I came into work very tired, and the woman told me I should just go home. When she asked how surgery went, and I said she's still in ICU and I really haven't got much sleep, she said, why don't you go home and be with your sister? It's more important. The woman has presented in the record repeated examples of this type of direct contradiction about the very same point, about the quality of being abusive, which is the alleged reason for her termination. On summary judgment, this creates a dispute of material fact as to whether or not Appleton Papers believed she was abusive or whether it manufactured evidence after the fact to justify an illegal termination. But there is no evidence of fabrication in this case. When asked in discovery for the reasons for the Bruin's termination, Appleton Papers responded under oath, quote, Mr. Bruin received the August 3rd warning letter, which made the following comments pertinent to present discussion, quote, additionally, I have questions surrounding your integrity as some inconsistencies in your conversations come to light. Dale Parker, the decision maker in this case, testified in deposition that the source of that alleged integrity concern was a statement made by Sandy Van Ert. The Bruin submitted an affidavit under oath on summary judgment by Sandy Van Ert stating, quote, I deny making any statement to Dale Parker that calls into question Mr. Bruin's integrity or trustworthiness. To the contrary, I have high regard for Mr. Bruin's integrity and trustworthiness. In 2001, Mr. Bruin was hired by Appleton Coated, pursuant to my recommendation, to serve as its credit manager. I would not have made such a recommendation if I were concerned about her integrity or trustworthiness. Finally, there is a third piece of evidence which calls into question the veracity of Appleton Papers' allegation that it fired Mr. Bruin for abusive supervisory style. And that is the June 23rd email. The facts. The first alleged employee complaints occurred in this case on June 19th and 22nd, 2000. Parker did not know about any complaints, however, until July 13th, 2000. Prior to that, on June 23, 2000, Beverly Stiber, a low-level human resources representative, sent to Parker an email about, quote, the DeBruin situation, close quote, seeking guidance about replacing the Bruin. The reasonable inference from these facts is that the June 23rd email references an antecedent conversation between Parker and Stiver. And that
why is that? I don't see why that is the necessary inference.
First, because we are at the summary judgment stage. The non-movement is entitled to reasonable inferences in her favor. The text of the email references, quote, the Deb de Bruin situation. And then it asks for guidance about the logistics of replacing her.
And there had been some unhappiness, at least management says there was some unhappiness with your client prior to the complaints of the three employees. Am I correct?
Your Honor, that is arguing with counsel. The evidence before the court on this record shows as follows. On the one hand, the black and white contemporaneous 1999 performance review given to the Bruin just 2 months before Parker became CFO by the former CFO, who had been her boss for almost 4 years off and on. He rated her exceptional on the very qualities at issue here: integrity, respect, trust, honesty. Contrast that with the only evidence presented by applicant papers, which is the affidavits of the allegedly complaining employees who said, no, she was an abusive supervisor. We were afraid of her. She was horrible. But those affidavits, at a minimum, because of their contradictions with the prior deposition testimony, raise a tribal issue of fact.
When were the depositions taken?
The unfolding of events went as follows. In response to the Bruin's EEOC charge, affidavits were submitted by applicant papers. The affiants were then cross-examined during discovery in civil litigation. Applicant papers then resubmitted nearly identical affidavits with new signatures in support of summary judgment. Therefore, those affidavits contradict prior sworn deposition testimony. Arguably, those affidavits should not even have been admitted under the rules of evidence on summary judgment. But even if they're admitted, it must raise a tribal issue of fact at this juncture. That's common sense rule 56 in the progeny that analyzes it, specifically Reeds versus Sanderson Plum, 5 U.S. 133, 2000, states that the court cannot credit impeached and contradicted evidence by an interested witness. And that too is just logical from the basic rule of summary judgment, that you can't make credibility determinations in favor of the moving party, and you can't make inferences in their favor either. But I want to get back to the original question. Applicant Papers has tried to pick out little pieces, one or two sentences, from the prior reviews to say that in fact maybe she wasn't so good after all. Well, this court said, in Courtney versus Biosound, 42 F3rd, 414, 1994 case, that when you review prior performance reviews, you can't go back and rewrite history. Those were objectively given.
That's not very realistic. These performance reviews are characteristically inflated. I think the reason is that supervisors, if they don't want to get rid of a person, which they didn't initially, then they like to, you know, make them feel good.
Your Honor, there's no evidence in the record to suggest that these weren't accurate reviews, in fact.
No, I'm just appealing to common sense. You say these recommendations tend to be inflated.
Well, Ann Rowland, who was the supervisor who gave the 1998 review, was examined at length in her deposition about it, and she reaffirmed everything that she had put.
You don't have people saying, well, you know, you're all right, I wouldn't fire you, you're mediocre, but it's good enough for me. But
well, in this case,
that's not the vocabulary of performance evaluations.
In this case, Your Honor, the reviews were not satisfactory. They were exceptional. But they must be coupled with the other evidence of fabrication. On summary judgment, the Bruin need only raise a tribal issue of material fact that the alleged reason for her termination was not, in fact, the real reason. Once she raises that inference, then it needs to go to a jury to determine whether or not the real reason was illegal gender discrimination. She has certainly done that by proving, A, the decision maker lied about one of his reasons, dishonesty, and that the whatever complaints were perhaps given to Beverly Stiver at the end of June have been greatly exaggerated, and three, Parker didn't even know about those complaints when he made the decision to fire her, given the June 23rd email and the reasonable inferences which can be drawn therefrom.
Okay, thank you. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Wilmington?
Morning, Your Honor. Please, the court, counsel. All of these arguments have been raised before. Judge Edelman reviewed all these arguments twice. He dismissed them. I respectfully submit that Judge Edelman's decision on reconsideration is the best argument for affirmance in this case. The plaintiff argues that she was fired because she was female, but the basic undisputed material fact, as Judge Edelman emphasized, is that three females came forward separately to a female HR supervisor with very serious concerns about inappropriate behavior. One of the important things about their statements was that they were afraid of the plaintiff, and they were afraid that the plaintiff was going to retaliate against her. These previous, as Judge Edelman also emphasized, these previous employee reviews are immaterial because the employer was not aware of this inappropriate behavior until these three ladies came forward in June of 2000. They came forward separately, but within a week's time, and they expressed a variety of concerns that directly implicated and were contravened the employer's anti-harassment policy.
And they kind of walked the cat back on those in their depositions, didn't they?
Well, Judge Edelman disagreed with that, Your Honor. He said that they were not in
compliance. Well, I got to look at it de novo, so why shouldn't I take the position that they really impeached themselves in those depositions?
Well, first of all, they did not contradict any material facts. Now, they may have...
Implied they did a pretty good job of indicating that they fell off the close, but they didn't.
Non-material facts, Your Honor. I mean, there's no dispute that they came forward. There's no dispute that they came forward and said, we fear the plaintiff. There's no dispute that they came forward and said, we fear the plaintiff is going to retaliate against us. Now, several years later, at deposition, they say, what I said in this deposition paints a better picture. Sure, the plaintiff has good qualities, but that, and they also said, Ms. Hartel said, the good qualities do not make the bad qualities not legitimate. Ms. Warner said, my affidavit is true. You know, so whatever they said in their deposition did not affect any.
Well, this goes to the fact of whether or not your client honestly believed.
Right. Well,
he had
pretext.
Right. I mean, that's the bottom line. Right?
In a pretext analysis, it is, Your Honor.
But he didn't have the deposition when he made his decision.
Well, I mean, the facts are this.
Am I correct? I mean, that was quite
right.
A bit later.
That would absolutely correct. Right.
So,
I mean, no reasonable juror could infer that Dale Parker, to whom Bev Stiver, the HR supervisor, who's female, reported to, no reasonable juror could infer that Dale Parker did not honestly believe that the plaintiff had engaged in inappropriate behavior that violated the company's.
So none of those depositions, in fact, say, that conversation between myself and a member of management didn't take place.
No, and Judge Edelman points that out. In page, I think, 30 of his reconsideration decision, he says the bottom line here is that it's unrefuted that these three women came forward with very serious complaints to Bev Stiver. Now,
even if it was the wrong call, it was an honest call.
Not only that, but as Judge Edelman also pointed out, the Olson decision and the Kosky decision and the Andriani decision all say that the plaintiff has to establish a reasonable inference that the employer did not honestly believe every reason that they put forward for termination. Now, there's a couple of things I'd like to emphasize in that regard. First of all, in the plaintiff's brief on page 13, I think it is, they represent three reasons. Yes, it's on page 13. They say Parker identified three specific concerns. And then they give a cite to the appendix 1, 293, and 312. Well, when you look up those cites, that's not what Mr. Parker said. His concerns were limited willingness to cooperate, imbalance in work and personal time, and three, severe problems with her employees/harassment.
Now, with respect to those matters, Mr. Robinson, where did your client first have those reservations about the performance of the plaintiff? Your colleague today has said that he has made much of the fact that he was apparently exploring options even before he knew of these three complaining employees. What was the basis for any misgivings he had before he heard about those three employees?
Well, as Judge Edelman pointed out, Your Honor, there had been forecasts of poor, let's call them people skills in the past, and that was somewhat in 92 and 98.
Yeah, so I want you to tell me that, and I don't care what Judge Edelman saw, I got to look at this thing over.
Okay, so there were some forecasts of people skill problems. In fact, in May of 2000, the plaintiff was asked to go to a what he called people skill training seminar. But that really isn't the picture here. The picture is that Apple Papers really had no reason to believe that there were these serious problems regarding the anti-harassment implications until these three women came forward in June. And the reason they didn't know that is because these women feared to come forward because they feared for retaliation. So you could have all the good recommendations and reviews in the world before that. We don't really dispute that she had been
checked. But counsel's point is that we apparently were making some thinking about exploring the possibility of removing her even before you knew of those three people.
That's not true. There's no evidence, there's no reasonable inference that could be made. They rely on this June 23 email. That's another thing I want to cite here. In their brief on page 14, they make the following statement. Judge Edelman also addressed this. On page 14, they say, this email, which by the way essentially said, based on my review of the situation, I have talked to David Vadillo about replacements for the plaintiff. They imply that necessarily, or at least that there's an inference from that Parker had already decided to terminate her at that point, mm-hmm. which was before the three women.
That's right. That's because my concern.
Right, because their logic is this. This is all a sham, this is all a lie, and to prove that, they have to show that Parker made a decision before the three women came forward. But when you look at the site that they provided, they say Parker admits that it reasonably leads to that inference, that he decided to terminate her before this June 23rd email. That site, that's not what it says at that site. Judge Edelman picked up on that and said, basically, the most you could infer from this email is that they contemplated replacing her on June 23rd. But you cannot take the giant leap from that and say that they had decided to terminate her.
And my question to you is, what would have been the basis, the factual basis, for such a contemplation? What information did the decision makers in your company have prior to the three people coming forward that would have permitted them, given them a permissible basis to contemplate the individuals?
I don't think they would have contemplated terminating her before these three women came forward.
But you just told me that email, at least at best, showed that they were, in fact, contemplating. That's what I'm trying to find out.
That's Judge Edelman saying that's an inference that I think could be reasonable from that email. I mean, we dispute that. I don't think that's reasonable at all, but the point is that he did not decide to terminate her until August 14th, and there's no reasonable inference that can be made prior to that.
When did Mr. Parker, in this record, first exhibit some unhappiness with the performance of Mr. Broom?
I think the record indicates that when he became CFO in February, he initially thought that she was doing a good job, but Mr. Broom became concerned about some of her interpersonal skills.
And what in the record is the factual basis for those initial concerns?
Well, there are some instances with regard to Lisa DeBruin, which are disputed, but there's some other concerns with regard to her conduct at meetings and things like that, but those really aren't relevant to the decision to terminate. The decision to terminate was based on this these three things that he testified into the record. Principally, this concern with anti-harassment policy, the employee problems that these three women raised. The Appleton Papers has an anti-harassment policy that basically says we need to treat all employees with respect. And if you cannot harass, you cannot retaliate harassment's actually defined in there as any conduct that would, any harassment that would take away from an employee's performance and those types of things. Clearly, when these three women stepped forward, and finally stepped forward, one of them actually spent over 6 years to work up the strength to come forward with these complaints. That's how much they were concerned about this. But after she steps, after these three women step forward and complain to the female HR supervisor, she turns around and reports this. Not only that, but after the second one came forward, her concerns were raised significantly enough that she asked a counselor named Funk to personally observe the plaintiff, which he did, and he corroborated the complaints of the women. Then she herself personally observed this, and so did Parker. After all that happened, that's when the decision to terminate was made. There's no other reasonable inference. And Judge Adelman, his opinion is the best argument for affirmance in this case. He's gone through all these arguments.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Robinson. And Ms. Gracias, if your time has expired. So we thank both of you, and court will be in recess until...